Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Hamburg and brought up in Hong Kong before attending a British boarding school and then the University of Oxford. After a stint in postgraduate research, he turned to literary journalism, working at the London Review of Books as an editor. He also worked as a football reporter, an obituary writer, a book editor at Penguin, and a restaurant critic. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker, among other major publications. He's written 5 novels and 4 works of non-fiction. The Guardian calls him a great literary polymath, a master of fiction and memoir, essays and journalism. He's been long-listed for the Booker and won many other awards. Capital, his 2012 post-crash State of the Nation novel, was adapted into a 3-part TV series. And his new novel, The Wall, examines some of the most compelling issues of our time: climate change, binary politics and the migrant situation. John Lanchester, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming, because your new book couldn't be more relevant at this time. I mean, obviously, most of the things that are happening now weren't happening when you sat down to write it. It seems like you had an ability to spot the zeitgeist.
Unfortunately, you could well say, since the newspaper headlines are pretty dark, it came out, I mean, it was sort of dreamlike image that turned into the book. It was an image of a man standing guard on a wall in the dark. And I suppose if it has a sort of accidental resonance with what's happening, I suppose maybe that's because on an unconscious level we often do process things from the newspaper headlines. I remember in the 80s, which were also quite a dark time, the early 80s politically, people would often dream about, you know, nuclear war or terrible disasters that had happened, and perhaps this is a little bit like that.
I want to come back and talk about this book in much more detail, but first of all, I want to start not at the beginning of your career, but with your 2007 book, Family Romance, which is your memoir, and it starts with events that happened even before you were born. Tell us about your mother.
My mother's story is the reason I wrote the book. Just before her funeral, in fact, after she died, but before her funeral, I found out that the name on my birth certificate, the name on my mother's identity papers, name on her passport, all that stuff, wasn't actually her, it was her sister. And she'd taken her younger sister's identity to take 10 years off her life when she met my dad. And the thing about my mum is she'd been a nun in India. She was born poor in the west of Ireland in 1920, which was a very, very different time and place. And Ireland was a very different country. And there were 7 girls in the family. They were farmers. And having 7 girls and 1 boy is actually a disaster in that milieu, because you've got to marry the girls off in that time and place. And so there was tremendous pressure to, you know, basically get rid of them. And one of the ways you got rid of them was if they became nuns, which is what my mother did, and was a missionary nun in India for 15 years. And then when she came out, I think after she met my father, I think she realised that, you know, to be more marriageable, she'd have to, you know, it would be very inconvenient to be 40. So she took this decision to be 30, and then it turned out to have huge consequences for the rest of her life in terms of isolating her from anyone who actually, you know, knew the truth.
And obviously made it difficult family life. I mean, you knew nothing about it, but you must have felt some kind of tension.
I think children, you know, I had a happy childhood, I'm not complaining about it, but children often know if there's something they're not being told, and there was an odd force field around certain sorts of subjects. So my mother, she's very, very proud of being Irish, but we never went there. She was proud of her family, but we had no contact with them. There was odd things around, you know, she would tell anecdotes about her time in India, because she ended up, she was running, it's a campus now, it's not just a school, called Church Park in Madras, and she has like 3 or 4 different schools in it, and she was running one of them. She was running a teacher training college, in effect. She was the principal, which is, you know, quite something for a woman in her mid-30s. You know, that far away from home, from anything familiar. But she'd tell anecdotes about India, but she wouldn't give sort of connected details. And all of this for the same reason, because it would be a way that the real story might come out. You say, well, hang on a minute. Why were, you know, for instance, she was at the inaugural ceremony when Mother Teresa founded her order. And she sort of alluded to it, but not going into any detail. And then, of course, because if she did go into detail, then you'd start, maybe you'd look up the date and start wondering how that was possible. So it wasn't this sort of giant dark cloud, but there were things that didn't quite make sense. You know, there were kind of there are a lot of dots left to join up. And of course, it all made, once I found out the real story, lots of things instantly fell into shape.
Mm. Do you think it had an effect on you? It's well, in fact, that you've been agoraphobic. Did you think that's stemmed from that in any way?
I think stemmed is too strong. I think, you know, people who have genetic predispositions to anxiety and stuff, it is what it is. But you can manage it and address it differently. I think the feeling of a big secret lurking in the background. I think my mother lived with a tremendous fear of exposure. It was always very, very difficult and charged thing going across a border. Anything to do with passports was very, very charged in ways which didn't really make sense as a child, and of course makes complete sense now. And I think that she had lived with a sense of a thing that could detonate, you know, that this thing that could completely blow up her life, because my father didn't know, nobody knew. And I think that may have fed into, you know, an inherent predisposition to kind of anxiety and the feeling of everything could suddenly go wrong at any given moment.
Mm.
You know, I think those two things overlapped.
But you did deal with it. I mean, you've managed it.
Yeah, I do. I mean, a ton of therapy helped. And also, I did something incredibly stupid, which is that I thought that writing the book would help. I thought that sort of excavating the story would help. And the reason that's incredibly stupid is because when you write, one of the things about writing is you have complete control over everything, every comma, every semicolon, mood, rhythm, timing, whether you publish it or not, you control the whole thing. And so that was actually no help at all in terms of excavating it and processing it. But what was very, very difficult, but it was helpful, was publishing it. Because that was the point at which I actually had to stand up and talk about it, as we're doing right now. And I really hated publishing that book. And every other book I've published, the process has got gradually easier. You feel funny at the beginning, and then you warm up, you get used to it, you get used to talking about it. But that got harder and harder and harder, partly because if you write about, I'd advise all your listeners, if you ever about to write about your life, people feel free to ask you absolutely anything. And I could, you know, well do without the things where people put up their hands in the audience and say, do you think your mother loved your father? You know, and that's, you know, the fact that they feel entitled to ask that question is entirely my fault for having written that book. And so it was very, very difficult. As I say, I hated it. It got worse. But at the end of it, it was, and I didn't notice it happening, but by the end of it, I had sort of excavated something. I had faced down the feeling of, you know, a secret that might detonate and go off. Mm. It was one of the oddest things that's ever happened to me. I suddenly realised, oh, I actually, without quite realising it, I did this, you know, big piece of psychic work while I wasn't quite realising it.
How did you come to write in the first place? I mean, you were at Oxford, you dabbled with postgraduate research and then decided to leave that behind.
Well, I'd always wanted to be a writer. One of the funny things that happened that I didn't realise was a particular historic moment at the time, but actually it turns out it was. I'd always wanted to be a writer. I'd assume I'd have to have a day job. And then just by chance, really, there was this thing, it became possible to freelance, to make a living freelancing for papers. And while I was a graduate student, I realised that's what I wanted to do instead of getting a teaching job or being an academic, which was the track I seemed to be on, that I didn't have quite the patience, I think, to be, you know, in graduate world. And I like being interested in new subjects, and it didn't quite work. You know, you had to immerse more extendedly for years and years. So I thought, no, what I'd rather do is sort of write pieces and be a journalist and write books at the same time. And the way that the newspapers worked, A, the newspapers had money, which is a strange and bizarre parallel reality now, but they did. And B, you could afford to live in London on not much money, which is another strange and bizarre parallel thing. And I thought, well, no, I'll do that. I'll do write bits and pieces and books on the side. And it was a long time actually finishing my first book, or indeed getting started on it, because I think I thought I'd wake up in the morning and found that I had written a book. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, look, there it is by the side of the bed. That tends not to work. So I finally, belatedly got around to it. But it was a long, long nursed plan. I'd wanted to be a writer since I was a kid.
Now, you were also a restaurant critic at one point, and your first book, The Debt to Pleasure, which came out in 96, is about a gourmet. It sounds the most wonderful story.
Yeah, he's a crazed snob, psychopath, mass murderer, actually, it turns out, as you're reading the book. And I was very interested in the idea of writing a book that pretended to be a cookbook, but was actually something else. So it acts like it's a cookbook, but it's actually a sort of thriller or a murder story. But the thing, as I said, I think he murders 9 people in the course of the book. He's the most snobbish, deranged person you can possibly imagine. And the question I was most often asked when it came out was, is it autobiographical? Which I never worked out how to answer that.
It won the Whitbread First Novel Award, the Betty Trask Prize, the Hawthornden Prize, the Julia Child Award for Literary Food Writing. I mean, it did incredibly well and really set you up then as a writer.
It did do very well. It was published in, I think, 25 languages, which was great fun as well, because there's lots of travel and zooming around associated with it. And it did well enough to let me quit my day job. I was deputy editor of the London Review of Books at that point. There was a very, very, this is 1996, and there was a very clear-cut thing about if I was going to try and make a living as a full-time writer, it was then or never. Mm. I mean, if I'd known the extent of the disruptions and chaos and mayhem in the industry that were coming, it would have been completely mad to make that choice. But I'm very glad I didn't. It worked out fine. It's just that the odds weren't really on it, because one of the odd things about being a writer, which I said I wanted to do since I was about 10, was that, you know, you had this mental image of it as not exactly sitting at a Victorian escritoire with a freshly dipped quill pen, but that basically it was just a stable landscape, and that the idea of being a writer meant the same thing. And in fact, it's been, you know, front row seat, or maybe even a driver's seat in this process of convulsive technological and economic, you know, revolutionary change across absolutely everything. In publishing, where I write my books, and also in journalism, which I, you know, do to pay the bills too. And that's been, you know, it's been fascinating, but it's not at all what I thought I was signing up for in 1996.
Your second book, Mr. Phillips, which came out in 2000, sort of looks at that change in a way. It deals with male middle-class concerns about getting older and the way that our lives change and aren't always in our control.
And also about work. I was interested in this story that came out after there was this horrible murder in the early 90s. A woman was stabbed to death in Wimbledon Common, Rachel Nickell. And the police investigated absolutely everyone. They made a map of everyone that was seen moving around on the common. And there was a person who several people reported. It was a man dressed in a suit just sitting on a park bench. And the police eventually traced him. And it turned out he was someone who'd been made redundant and who was going out to work every day and hadn't told his family. And that really stuck in my head. That was the seed of the book. And made me think a lot about male identity being linked to work, which I think, I'm not sure if that's still historically as true. I was very interested in whether that was a kind of particular thing of a particular moment, where, you know, female identity was around motherhood and male identity was around work and the idea of providing. And it struck me as a thing that was shifting, this landscape was shifting quite quickly. And the other linked thing was that it was completely rational to be someone like my father, who worked for the same company for 30 years and then retired. That was sort of what work was. You had one employer across a lifetime. And I was very struck by the fact that that was a normal thing to think. If you were born in, the character in the novel was born in 1945, lots of people thought that then. I was born in 1962, nobody my age thought that. You know, that had completely gone, that idea of an entirely stable landscape of work where work is your identity. And that was the nexus of questions I was interested in.
And it's a theme that you really carried on with, because you have a couple of books and many, many articles on the world of finance. So, and I'm interested in the way that your book Capital, which is possibly the book people know you most for, came about, because you were writing it and then actually writing non-fiction at the same time.
I wanted to write a novel about London, partly because, as you mentioned in the bio, I'm not from London. I was very struck by how much the city had changed, you know, convulsively, I thought, out of all recognition. But I think a lot of people who were from here hadn't noticed. They were like the proverbial boiling frog that starts in the cold water and doesn't notice. So I wanted to write a novel about a big fat London novel, I called it in my head. And then I started thinking about London and looking around, and I suddenly realised that actually I didn't understand it. And that the thing I was interested in was this change. And the driver of change is all to do with finance. That finance is the sort of magic wand that made London this very rich, cosmopolitan world city. a world city, or some people think the world city. And if I wasn't taking interest in that, I didn't know, you know, the force determining who my neighbours were. I mean, not in a metaphorical way, literally the people who lived in my street. And so I started taking interest in it. And while I was studying it and reading up and trying to understand it, that's when the credit crunch happened. And so I ended up writing in parallel, really, pieces and now a couple of books about finance and economics, in a way as the, you know, the wizard behind the curtain of the modern world.
And just to help real laymen understand how and why it all went wrong and why it works.
Well, I got very interested in that. I mean, that partly because, you know, with these huge economic forces around us and above us, it's very difficult to feel that we have any agency or any control. And actually, that feeling is correct. A lot of the time we don't. But in order to just begin that process of having some grip on the circumstances around you, I felt that action of understanding is very important. It's a very important place to begin from. And that feeling of, I remember hearing a firefighter had been made redundant, his wife on some radio program, saying, you know, tell us what we did wrong. What did we, you know, what could we have done different? And the answer was actually nothing. You know, these things happened to you, and there's not one single solitary thing that you could have done different or that you did wrong. And that is a very, very difficult thing to hear. We're so imbued with the idea that we have agency over our own lives. But actually, with these big economic things, sometimes we just don't. And that makes understanding the processes, I think, you know, more important.
Capital was made into a television series.
It was, which won an International Emmy Award. And my now friend, we didn't know each other then, the producer Derek Wax, who went to, and Pete Bowker, who wrote it, genius TV writer who wrote it, went to the award ceremony in New York, obviously not knowing they were going to win. And then did, and Derek went up to accept it. And it was in the Hilton Hotel in New York, and he was actually standing at the same podium, talking into the same microphone that Donald Trump had stood at when he accepted his victory speech 2 days before. So it was quite a strange occasion. The entire room was basically still in shock, you know, reeling. And so Derek said it was a profoundly surreal moment standing, you know, standing in the place where Trump had stood.
I can quite imagine. I wonder if it felt surreal for you seeing your work now envisaged by somebody else on the screen.
No, it's very, very peculiar because it's completely familiar and completely alienating or strange at the same time. And I didn't really get used to that. I thought they did a very good job, and I had a very happy experience of the whole process, which isn't something you often hear writers say about being adapted or indeed about anything else. So it's great fun, and I really enjoyed it, but it never lost that sense of otherness.
Before we talk about The Wall, which I just can't recommend enough to people, a quick chat about your book on the tube, because that's just so fascinating, for particularly for Londoners who use it every day, to speak to somebody who's had unique access and actually driven with a driver and been on that journey with them.
Well, Penguin did this thing for the 150th anniversary of the tube, which I think is 2013. They had a short book about every line, and I wanted to do a thing. I thought everyone else would have the same idea, so I wanted to get in first. And in fact, nobody did the same thing, which is to go out with a tube driver, because I wanted to see that, you know, just literally see what it was like. I've always wondered my whole life what that was like. And it was completely fascinating. And, you know, as you'd expect, the Underground is this whole world. And you have a fantastic view. You know, it's like that thing when you're in planes sometimes now, they have the little camera, but you can see what the pilot sees. And that, it's very interesting how different the view out the front is, because you can see the stations a long way away. It makes the tunnels much less alarming because there's usually lights in the distance and you know where you are. And the drama of going from the dark to the light and vice versa, which you do get on the District Line regularly. It's also the only line that goes both under and over rivers, because there's a little tenor bit on Sloane Square Station where one of the minor tributaries of the Thames is piped over the platform, which is the point at which the District Line goes under a river, and then it goes over the river on the way to Putney, which is, if you're a tragic underground nerd, there's something really amusing about that. So no, I really enjoyed that and learnt a lot.
Mm. Let's turn now to what should be dystopian fiction, but actually feels a little bit more like reality. And this is your new book, The Wall. It's, as I said at the beginning, seems hugely to foretell the situation that we're in now. So perhaps if you set out the landscape, this is a country, a world, a universe that's been ravaged by the change.
It's set in a world after profound and irrevocable climate change. And it's set in an island nation, which is more or less Britain, which has a 5 metre high concrete wall or polder, as it technically is in engineering. It's a thing to keep the water out when the water's higher than the land, all the way around the coast. So the whole country is behind this fortification, and every citizen in the country has to spend 2 years in what's effectively a form of national service, standing guard on the wall to stop people getting over it, because this change, this catastrophic world-altering climate change, has displaced hundreds of millions of people and who are fleeing, and the job of the people who stand on the wall, the defenders, is to stop them getting over.
And those people are called the Others, which is becomes an absolutely sort of chilling word. They're desperate souls. They're trapped in the rising seas outside and obviously want to come in. If they do, then there are terrible consequences for the defenders who let them come in.
Yeah, the way it works is that you do your 2 year tour of duty on the wall, and if anyone gets over it in your section on your watch, you're put to sea and you become an other yourself.
And the others who make it over can choose to be euthanized.
Yeah, they can be executed, they can be put back to sea, or they can become help, as it's called in the novel, which is effectively indentured servitude or slavery.
Which sounded so fascinating, because here was a possible workable model of migrants coming into a place and being given a job, being given food and drink, being given a way to carry on living. But of course it is, as you say, slavery.
Well, I've always been interested in the way that choices become normalised, the way that people in a society don't necessarily see the morality of what they're doing, that everything becomes habitual. There's a wonderful novel of all the sort of, you know, prize reading fated books of the last 20 odd years. The one I think you hear least about, certainly in proportion to its merits, is a novel by Valerie Martin called Property. And it's about slavery. But I remember when I worked in publishing, some literary grandee wrote a novel about slavery, and then my boss at Penguin sort of announced this fact and then sort of said, he's against it, rather mordantly. And the thing about Property is that it's a novel narrated from the perspective of a woman slave owner. And she's in favour of it. And it's all about the sort of mental landscape of what it's like from the oppressor's point of view. And it's an absolutely fantastic book I'd unreservedly recommend, but it's a very, very uncomfortable book, which is one of the reasons you don't hear as much about it as you should. And I was really interested by that, the way that you can have brutal realities of how we live and the way our societies work that get completely, as I say, normalised and ignored and not seen.
Mm. You really take us into the heart of this world, the cold of it. You talk about the poetry of it, the concrete, the wind, the wet, the cold. It just, we really feel it. We're right there with you. It then turns into this wonderful survivalist sea story.
I thought I didn't want to leave. You know, a story has to be a story. A story has to go somewhere. And yeah. I've always been interested in a thing about national service, being in the army, all that is this funny mixture of, you know, every day is the same and you're longing for something to happen and yet you're completely terrified that it might happen. Mm. And yet part of you, even though you know you're terrified, secretly wants it to happen anyway. You know, there's a funny dialectic between the kind of the daily tedium and the kind of horror of the thing you fear, which is also the thing you train for, which is also the thing you expect, which is also the thing you dread. You know, it's this funny cocktail of that.
I guess that goes back to your tube driver too.
It does, yes. No, yeah. I mentioned when we were talking privately before that it has this funny combination of monotony, being a tube driver, because, you know, every day is the same, you're completely on your own, which is the thing people don't appreciate about them. I mean, I think it's a thing people say, blah, 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 tube drivers earn too much, but actually if you've been out with them, that's not true, because it's this complete monotony, on your own, 8 hours a day, can't use your phone for obvious reasons, can't look away. And if you miss one red light, you know, the whole, you know, 40, 50 people die, as famously happened once, and there was an accident in the 70s at Moorgate Station, and nobody knows what happened. The driver might have had a heart attack, but he missed a signal, and you know, it was a proper catastrophe. So being a tube driver is this odd mixture of monotony, tedium, and you know, incredibly high stakes if you make a single mistake. And I am interested in that the, you know, the mixture of dailiness and extremity that you get in quite a few jobs. And I think that thing about standing guard is like that. Mm. And that's where, no spoilers, but, you know, things do happen. The reader will be relieved to know.
So much happens, and it is this wonderful kind of adventure. One of the things it also throws up is how much resentment there is between generations, how basically the previous generation have just screwed it for their kids.
Well, I was thinking about what it'll be like if we have this, if we have this change affecting the whole planet, how it will seem intergenerationally, you know, how we, I mean, I really do specifically mean us, since it's happening on our watch, how we will seem to subsequent generations, our descendants, our children, people looking back at this moment when we have a chance to stop it. And in the novel, it's very personalised. It's about parents who grew up in a different world. And the children feel they really have just nothing to learn from them, and they just don't want to hear about, you know, how they see things, what they think. They think, well, you broke the world, just leave us alone.
What's the future, John?
Well, the thing about this moment, from the papers published in the Katowice conference, the UN climate body, is that we can stop it. You know, we are poised on a knife edge. We can hold climate change at 1.5 degrees centigrade. We've had 1 degree since the end of the Industrial Revolution. Since the Industrial Revolution, we can hold it at 1.5. And the difference between that and the previous best-case scenario of 2 degrees is, you know, hundreds of millions of lives being saved or being saved from catastrophic impacts. So it's not too late. You know, this is a moment of great, great risk, but we can act. We have a chance, maybe our last chance, but we can act right now.
And I would suggest to people that part of acting is to inform themselves and to do so in a wonderfully entertaining way. Read The Wall. John, thanks so much for coming in. The Wall by John Lanchester is published by Faber and Faber on the 17th of January. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans and David Stevens. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.